Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagha Mradian, and I hope everybody had a very happy Thanksgiving. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. We recently interviewed United States Air Force Lieutenant General Brad Webb, the commander of the Air Education and Training Command, composed of some 70,000 airmen and 1,400 aircraft that oversees educating airmen throughout their careers, from boot camp to initial, intermediate, and advanced training, and Squadron Officer School, Air War College, and Air University. General Webb, sir, thanks so very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Vago. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Glad to have you aboard. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Sir, obviously an extraordinary time. You know, just before we got started, we were talking about Thanksgiving and how everybody is trying to figure out how to safely hold family gatherings, right? I mean, folks are deciding that maybe smaller gatherings are maybe the way to go on this, with a little bit more social media and Zooming or FaceTiming people. But at the end of the day, your command is responsible for training, which is at the heart of the Air Force enterprise. Talk to us about how you guys, you know, the impact of COVID on the command, but also how you guys are managing to execute the mission while also being as safe as you can.
Yeah, thanks, Vago. The day that the order came, the shelter in place order came down, Friday the 13th of March, was really kind of a moment, right? It was a moment for the Air Force. It was certainly a moment inside Air Education Training Command. And, we just kind of determined inside our command that while we didn't say this probably consciously, but we kind of went into a contingency mindset. You know, it wasn't a named operation or anything, but we kind of took that stance. And in fact, we quickly developed a mantra of fighting through. We need to fight through. There was a lot of conversation with the chief of staff of the Air Force, General Goldfein at the time, over that weekend on, how we were going to orient. And at the end of the day, you know, that next week, we started that way. And really, it's been our stance the whole time. I'm really proud of the efforts of the airmen in the command that we've been, you know, very successful in being able to sustain what ultimately is Air Force readiness by continuing our production.
Let me ask you about how you guys are not only right executing now, but you're also changing how you train. You just put your new vision out, which is very, very cool. It's a different way of thinking about AETC from how normally we think of it. And that's to develop the airmen we need from in Air Force parlance, right? Dawn. Talk to us about how you guys are leveraging new technology as part of this vision, right? Because now we've got much, much less expensive augmented virtual reality training systems that are both inexpensive but also very, very high fidelity that can be used for almost anything, any kind of educational purpose. Talk to us about that vision and the role of new technology and executing it with a new generation of airmen.
You bet. I got in command here at Air Education Training Command in summer a year ago, year and a half ago. And this command at that time was already oriented on a vision that was really bringing learning and, you know, learning systems and learning management into the 21st century, let's say. My charge, if you will, as I interpreted it, was really to operationalize what was an excellent vision. But we had made little progress beyond just experimentation, which, of course, you know, is the absolute order that you have to go through. And so that AETC is that you referred to, we developed that in my first month or so in command, and then. And it aligned, of course, with General Goldfein's priorities. General Brown, who's now the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, you know, he has his accelerate, change, or lose, and the action orders that are ABCD, right? Airmen, bureaucracy, competition, design, implementation. And that actually dovetails perfectly into what we've laid out inside AETC, those sub bullets. Now, the major bullets, I should say, the sub bullets underneath there are going to evolve over time. Just world events are going to be such that about every 6 months, you got to relook at this. And so obviously in the course of the last 6 months with COVID, and frankly, some of the diversity and inclusion challenges that we've had in the Air Force has caused us to look, you know, relook at our priorities and specifically the sub bullets contained therein and tweak them. So you get to that just articulation of developing the airmen we need. About a little less than a year ago, it was clear that the Air Force was going to treat this year's programmatic direction on airmen because we had spent a lot of time on weapon systems. And so AETC is kind of rightly situated to be able to lead with that effort more so maybe than the other commands, just because of the number of functions that we have that are airmen centric. And so we developed a program that ensured that the programmatic development of the last year could be encapsulated. And that's where that phrase, developing the airmen we need, came from. And like you said, it is based a lot on some of the learning technologies and the learning systems that have been underway. But it was a good opportunity to marry those two together.
You know, you have advance, enhance, transform, and cultivate as being sort of the core elements of executing that plan. And that's actually very encouraging to say that you've got to, in this kind of competitive, dynamic, and fast-moving world we're in, need to be reconsider. You know, like have core principles, but you know, sort of keep adjusting given how things are changing. From your standpoint, what's the role of technology in this change? Right. I mean, if you look at somebody who's sort of, you know, always been interested in flying and have an X number of flying hours, I find it a lot easier to fly a simulator than I do a real airplane. And also the chances of me actually killing myself in a real airplane, not flying it often enough is enough of a risk right there. Right. I mean, that's something that I remember former Air Force Secretary and former Defense Secretary Harold Brown once told me. You know, he wanted to learn how to fly. And Curtis LeMay leaned in and said, you know, you're just going to kill yourself because you're never really going to be good enough at flying, right? So I don't want to be one of these guys who has very little hours and then gets up there and gets himself into trouble. But, I mean, these simulators are really extraordinary in their fidelity. How do you see this new technology in virtual and augmented and all of the other ways that it's approaching us in terms of changing education? How is it changing how AETC is delivering its mission?
It's changing it fundamentally. You know, the Air Force was born as a kind of a technologically oriented service to begin with. So we do kind of like to consider that, you know, it's in our DNA. But some key technologies have come that have evolved to the state that really the 1970s approach to learning simply had to be updated. And that really was the vision that you know, was laid out by my predecessors and, you know, and specifically in the areas of, you know, data, you know, big data collection, immersive training devices that would, you know, be able to blend virtual reality, machine learning, artificial intelligence. All of that has come to a state where it is extremely useful. And the population that joins the military, and specifically the Air Force these days, they're already very oriented, right, to technology. So now it's just a matter of making them savvy in these areas that we want to drill in on. And so from that standpoint, you know, what began inside this command is PTN or Pilot Training Next has blossomed into every nook and cranny that you could point to inside this command.
And so talk to us a little bit about how you're doing it. For example, you used to have classes, whereas you don't, you have classes, but now folks don't have to learn at the pace of the slowest in that class. There are folks that you're actually getting out to operational units faster. Talk to us about how you're fundamentally changing, you know, as you said, that 1970s mindset to a much newer, more flexible, operationally oriented mindset.
Sure. You know, and the T, you know, and that AETC that you referred to is transform the way we learn. I think what we've discovered really over the course of pilot training and then also our technical training is a handful of principles that are kind of fundamental to this. It's like you kind of alluded to, early access to content, you know, having devices where this trainee or the student can plug into Wi-Fi, plug into the cloud, and be able to study at their own pace, right? So maybe even before they start the block of instruction, they have access. It's that blended learning that I talked about just a moment ago with respect to, you know, artificial intelligence, machine learning, et cetera. We've kind of what we call flipped the classroom. And in other words, instead of the mind's eye of how we learned, where there's a teacher at the front of the classroom and there's, you know, blackboard or what have you, and students, you know, kind of sitting facing forward. In many of the courses, you know, darn near all of them at this point, you have a facilitator that's in the room, but the airmen are able to really kind of teach themselves and get oriented that way. There are any number of examples I can give you of where that's really just blossomed because they're able to use that that technology the way they've kind of, you know, grown up. And so those are some of the fundamentals. And then of course, when I didn't really hit on the question you asked me a minute ago about the simulator aspect of that, but for pilot training, that comes directly into play. But it also works even in the VR world, the virtual reality world, with any number of technical things like civil engineering, like intelligence training, you know, weather training, cyber training, et cetera. All of these lend themselves right to, they're very rife with being able to use this to maximum advantage.
And of course, then you're right. I mean, it's sort of like was training manuals, right? I mean, you used to go through training manuals and used to see this dated stuff, whereas actually now you're at the speed of relevance, aren't you, in terms of how you can shape and tailor your curriculums. Yeah.
That's right. So, you know, we've kind of aligned ourselves to be directly linked up with industry so that we can tweak this as we learn, because, you know, in a number of ways, we're never going to grow out of the experimentation. We are, you know, we use a little of a metaphor that I find very helpful, the Thomas Edison and the Henry Ford. You know, the Thomas Edison approach is those early days of you know, PTN, pilot training next. These guys are experimenters. They're out inventing electricity, inventing the phonograph, inventing the light bulb, et cetera. And we're trying to move into the Henry Ford stage, which is the mass production of this. How do you scale what's working, right? And provide that to you name it, pilot training, or to all the maintenance training and all these other kind of areas that we want to go. But the beauty of it is we're never going to grow out of that Thomas Edison stage as well, because we want to be able to adapt quickly. Because I mean, it's kind of fundamental to what General Brown lays out in his strategy piece. We simply have to be able to accelerate change.
Are you satisfied with the speed with which you're Henry Fording the enterprise?
I would say that I'm pleased with the efforts that are underway. We have a lot of roads still in front of us to travel. So I would not declare that for sure that we're over the goal line in any stretch of way, shape, or form. I'm pleased with, we're still really early on this journey. And I still think that there's a lot that we will, that's yet to be gained. So no, I'm not satisfied, but I am pleased with where we're, certainly with the direction. Let me put it this way. We've moved out of the demonstration phase for sure and are into scaling, but we're in the early days of it.
Let me ask you about pilot training next, right? You're in the third iteration of it, if memory serves correctly. And it is one of the most complex things that the Air Force does, which is to create very, very skilled aviators and air crews. Obviously, the maintainers and all of that is as important as anything and all the other skill sets the Air Force does. But at the end of the day, it's about that delivery of that combat power. You know, in your case, you're a command pilot with 3,700 hours in legendary airplanes like the UH-1, the MH-53, and of course the CV-22 as well. Until the pandemic, the United States Air Force and each of the military services was having a terrible time with pilot retention. Very experienced aviators were going out because of high op tempo and frankly, airlines that were willing to pay a lot of money. And so the challenge became, how do you more rapidly train a new generation of, right? You were working retention on the one hand, but then it was like, hey, can we bring pilots and train them more quickly and economically? Where are you on that cycle? Because the Air Force has tried to be very traditional in how it trains pilots, right? It's not like an airline where you have 1,500 simulator hours and the first time you fly an airplane has passengers in the back of it. You guys aren't ready to do that. How are you reinvigorating and changing the training model that in some respects does have roots that go back to the beginning of the Air Force in terms of just hands-on and flying a lot?
Yeah. So we've completed the third, like you said, iteration of a PTN class. We are now at the phase where we are scaling this. We've scaled it at a couple of our bases. And by next summer, we hope to have scaled it across all of our undergraduate pilot training bases. And we're really kind of reorienting the pilot training experimentation efforts, if you will, to what comes the step behind that, or the not behind it, but the step, the next step. So, so what we found is that there are efficiencies to be had. There is a quality quotient that you can accelerate. I would like to, you know, reiterate that we're three classes into this and now scaling at in the early stages of that. But what we're finding is I don't believe we're going to have a fundamental game changer with respect to the time that it takes to grow a pilot to a level that we will be satisfied to put in the field and be operational. But what we have found is that the quality of the product, in this case of a pilot, that graduates with wings and produces is excellent. The blend of what you can do in the virtual world, coupled with, of course, what happens in reality, which is important, and I can return to if you'd like on a moment, if you'd like. But that's still very important. But what we'll have is a very high quality student or high quality pilot that still lacks experience. I mean, there is experience in the operational world that we haven't overcome yet. And by the way, it's a very instructor intensive environment, as we've discovered with all the simulated pieces that are going on. So, you know, I think that the next area that we're going to need to see a really big movement is how we can take AI, artificial intelligence, and machine learning to kind of help alleviate some of the burden that's placed on instructors even there. So there's kind of a way ahead there. And back to the kind of the question you asked me on, are we satisfied? I think it's how you asked it, with the production. The early stages are good, but we're, you know, as when you experiment, you find other challenges. And that one, I think, is going to be central to us, is how do we alleviate some of the burden off the instructors and still able to produce the way we want to produce.
So let's talk a little bit about that burden and what the challenge is, right? Because there's a perception with all of this new technology that you're actually making things easier for the instructor, but you can also move people through this pipeline a lot faster. But what you're saying is actually, the time span is maybe the same, whereas the output maybe is a little bit better. Talk to us about that, so that people in their minds sort of understand what the challenge is to doing this, and that there is actually maybe not quite the panacea that some people had hoped that this technology would be.
And I think there's the initial results are very promising. But to say that, hey, we can, what used to take a year to produce, 1,200 pilots, we can now do in 6 months and produce, 2,000, that's unrealistic. We can do slightly better in our numbers. And certainly, in the Air Force, because of the conditions that, we find ourselves in with respect to the airline industry and COVID, it's given us a reprieve from the retention standpoint. But we do need to dial this in. The simulator, the use of simulators, the use of immersive training devices is extremely helpful. But we are not at a state where a virtual instructor is lock, stock, and barrel teaching a student. And so the interactions still occur with training devices, and they still occur in an airplane. And these are, oftentimes the same instructor pilot. So there is still a good burden that is being shouldered by our instructor force. That's not in and of itself bad, but I just think it does point the way forward to where we look to be able to dial in the controls a little more.
Let me ask you about what you're learning from your Army, Navy, and even Marine counterparts. When you went through Fort Rucker, was it in 1984? You graduated the Air Force Academy in 84, right?
Right. Yeah, I went to Fort Rucker from 84 to 85. That's right.
To learn to fly the legendary Huey. What are things that you're learning from your sister services, right? I mean, what's the sort of network you guys have created to share some of these training lessons across the piece as each of the services try harder? I remember, in the pre-pandemic days, was down in Orlando talking to the Navy training folks about how they were trying to leverage technology across the board to help improve Navy training. What are you learning and picking up and sharing with the other services to make sure that you're all collectively stepping your game up?
Yeah, there's a lot of crosstalk, as I assume you would hope there would be between the services, and especially in the training commands. We've done any number of exchange visits with Marines, with the Army, and the Navy as well. And in fact, in our pilot training next program, the T-6 jets that we're flying right now are Navy loaned because they're the B model T-6s. They have some more of the advanced avionics that we don't have currently in our T-6 A's. And so a lot of good crosstalk. And I do envision that we'll, in future kind of iterations of this, be reaching out internationally as well. The PTN program in particular has a lot of interest from our international partners and allies. We're not at a stage, I think, where we can turn that spigot on a full blast just yet. The point is, there's a lot of good ideas in the other services and from other countries that we need to be rightfully positioned to have as much crosstalk as we can, because that's just going to advance the product in every way, shape, and form.
You mentioned a platform, and I'd be remiss if I didn't bring in the T-7 into this argument. Obviously, the next generation trainer by Boeing and by Saab that's going to revolutionize United States Air Force training, replacing the T-38, one of the best looking jets in history ever made, and one that's just an incredibly good training airplane at the end of the day. I think folks didn't recognize the twin engine wasn't just a redundancy issue, but actually a complexity issue, so that when you were doing advanced training, you would be on approach, guy in the back seat or gal leans forward, shuts down an engine, and now Brad has a much more complicated problem to try to solve. How is the T-7 going to be changing and improving the quality of product that you field from the command?
Well, the T-38, as you rightfully point out, has been a workhorse for the Air Force since 1961. And it still is, you may be able to hear in the background the jets as they go by here where I'm at this morning. But They've done, I mean, it's a fantastic jet. The T-7 is going to rightfully position us to take the next step forward for the right generation of flying, but also with the right, it just advances in avionics more than anything else. And so, you know, the charge that we have inside AETC is to ensure that when we start employing the T-7, that we employ it with this same methodology that you and I have been talking about for the last chunk of minutes, and not just try to do the same T-38 training in this case that we've done since 1961, just in a different jet. And the avionics and the characteristics, the flying characteristics of the T-7 is going to provide us that opportunity. So we got to make sure we don't squander that as we bring it on board. We're very excited to get the T-7.
Let me ask you, our time is running short, so I've got just a couple more questions. Let me ask you about how you're preparing for a new generation of military training. You know, when you talk to folks in the Pentagon, I was talking to our mutual friend Dave Deptula recently, and at this point, our adversaries have such pervasive surveillance capability that if we're holding any large-scale exercise in the open, they can monitor it, they can try to derive lessons. What are the sort of hard operational problems we're trying to solve? And so there is this drive to try to create these vast, highly realistic, synthetic training environments that are both for concept development, but also for just sort of training at all levels, where you can hold these sort of large scale exercises that you would in real life away from prying eyes. How are you preparing for that future and AETC's role in readying airmen for that future, which is not that far off?
No, it absolutely isn't. I would say really, there are two real lanes in the road that AETC, one that AETC's forged, the other that I think is wheelhouse. The one that we forged is this kind of operational thought process that started in this command called Squadron Next, that really looks at how do you organically sustain? How do you do command and control at a squadron level? How do you understand what the National Defense Strategy has charged us with understanding commander's intent, understanding mission type orders, and being able to move out in small, smaller groups rather than a huge organization. We've passed that over to the operational major commands in the Air Force to take to the next level. While inside AETC, we want to focus on the wheelhouse of that airman. How do we teach and orient our airmen to be able to have the confidence and the authority to understand commander's intent and move out? That is the fundamental mindset shift that encompasses developing the airmen we need. And so, you know, we call Air Education Training Command the first command, right? There's not an airman that doesn't enter the Air Force that doesn't come to AETC first. And that's got to be wheelhouse kind of work that we need to assure that we establish. And so whether, you know, we have some words that and some processes, some, you know, kind of doctrinal alignment on multi-capable airmen and this type of thing that is going to help us get after that. And AETC will be leading those efforts.
How do you, let me ask a follow-up on that. So how are you, right? So when you entered the Air Force, we were still at the height of the Cold War. There was still a notion of mission command, a lot of MCON alpha work. And then over the decades, we have become very comfortable at communicating, communicating at will, communicating very freely. In fact, in Iraq and Afghanistan, there were things that we were doing that weren't even encrypted because we didn't think our adversaries, we learned that our adversaries, you know, had more capability than we thought they did. At the end of the day, what is the education change that you're doing with a new generation of airmen that are used to pervasive communication, pervasive connectivity? How are you teaching them? Because that's a reordering of thinking, isn't it? That you've got to think differently about the problem, what you understand at your last conversation, because you will not be able to call in maybe and clarify things with General Webb.
That's exactly right. But you know, the key to it, as I see it, is, you know, you were kind of laying out in the example that you gave, there were some very innovative, they weren't just airmen, they were airmen and soldiers and Marines and you know, what have you, but airmen were included in this, that saw a problem set, really invented on the fly unique methods, to get after the problem. Now there is some security challenges with that, absolutely. But you see, the burgeoning of that, mindset, of, airmen, soldiers, Marines, sailors to really orient on, a challenging, problem set and be innovative about their approaches. You saw it, as you stated, in, Iraq and, Syria, where you see airmen that are just, understanding what the problem is and coming up with unique solutions. You see it likewise with some of the apps that, you know, airmen had available to them when they responded to some of the hurricane challenges a few years ago in Texas and Louisiana, and being able to link that up with first responders from the community so that they could go and rescue folks. That is exactly the mindset that we have to establish in our airmen, because that is the kind of mindset we're going to need in the future. They understand commander's intent. In this case, it was go find and rescue your fellow citizens and use whatever means is necessary. That's that example. In a war fighting environment in much smaller clusters than I think we're going to have seen be the norm in the past, we're going to have that same agility of mind, the flexibility and the authority and the confidence to be able to move out along that line of thought. So technology can help there, but that mindset, really, we want to implant in them in the very earliest days in basic training and technical training.
But you're seeing that actually they are exhibiting that degree of flexibility, and so folks shouldn't be as worried about that, right? I mean, there's this little bit of a concern that, hey, they grew up with smartphones in their hand, and once I cut the smartphone off, they won't be able to think as flexibly or as innovatively. But what you're saying is that they actually are and able.
They are.
Yeah.
That's yeah, I see it. I see it every day. And I see it even from the youngest airman and certainly up through the NCO ranks and into the officer ranks. So what we as leaders have to reinforce that is exactly the behavior that we not just like, but that we expect from you. But it's there in spades.
Let me ask you about cyber, which is a warning domain in its own right. You know, we're finding that, you know, we live in 24/7 in a cyber domain, even if we're in a cockpit only a couple of hours a day. And there is this concern that folks focus on their principal warfighting specialty, right? You're an aviator, but you did joint tours, so you get good at land warfare and you get good at sea warfare. But there's this sense that nobody is really as good at, for example, cyber operations as maybe they need to, which I've even had senior leaders admit to me. What are some of the fundamentals to make sure that you're bringing that kind of education, sir, not just across the force at the junior most level, but actually up and down the chain of command, given that that's a domain that is persistently being contested right in your computer right now?
Yeah, that's right. And the biggest, I think, mindset challenge that we have in our community anyway is the defensive mindset. And you kind of just laid that out. You know, with that approach of being innovative, using the tools that you can see that are easy to apply to get to a situation concluded in a successful way, is the challenge of security. And so in that backdrop, we'll find ourselves needing to really be masters of that in the forefront of our process as we go through it. Very easy to say, much harder to do. That is a key mindset in which I think, you know, unfortunately, we still have a lot of road to travel.
Are you making the kind of progress on that that you would like across the board? I mean, you know, it's sort of funny that when you talk to service academies, for example, that oftentimes it's, you know, for some folks would say that by the time you're 18 and going to a service academy, it may be, it's great that you're doing that cyber education, but there's this sense that that cyber education should be starting much earlier to create sort of better habits at the end of the day. Are you making as much progress as quickly as you feel you need to? And if not, how do you speed it up when it comes to cyber?
Probably it's fair to say that, earlier would obviously be better from that standpoint. The goodness that I see is that as the cyber command has matured, certainly with inside the Air Force, you know, we now have a numbered Air Force that helps orient us as a service that way. These are all excellent steps in the right direction. But I would be being Pollyannish if I said, hey, there's a lot to go still. You know, we have the challenges of many different systems that do similar things that may be proprietary challenges to be able to connect. There's some basic blocking and tackling efforts still that we need to go. It would be very helpful, for instance, if all of our systems were able to interact with each other and you know, cut down on the challenges of breaking through firewalls that have nothing to do with the enemy, but have to do with proprietary challenges. Once you get through that, then you can rightfully focus on the cyber challenges that are coming from those that wish to do us harm. But those are areas that the Air Force recognizes and will be the next steps that I see for great advancement.
It's certainly going to be something that when you're in a JADC2 future, the Joint All Domain Command and Control future, is going to be something that is very, very important to try to get everybody on that same fundamental plane. Let me ask you a more lighthearted question. You flew the UH-1, which is one of the most, the Huey is one of the most legendary helicopters and also the coolest sounding helicopter, I think, can't be beat.
That's right.
You flew the 53, which is very radical. Different aircraft with gigantic and just mind-altering amount of power going through it. And then you flew the V-22, which is a tilt rotor and completely different airplanes. Two of them, of course, manufactured by our sponsor, Bell. Of course, the V-22 is Bell and Boeing.
Right.
Talk to us about the difference of flying these really different airplanes.
Well, you know, yeah, the Huey, the sound of a Huey is, you know, every time I hear it, I say, that's the sound of freedom right there. And of course, it was the first helicopter that I really learned to fly. We flew these little TH-55s in those days for a few hours, but I had several years in the Huey. I flew the MH-53 for over 20 years. And that's really, you know, that when you strap on something like that, it would still be like a fit in a glove. They're now retired, but last week I was out at Kirtland Air Force Base and flew the 60, which of course is a Sikorsky product as well. And it felt like flying a 53. It's a smaller version, but still, you kind of really feel at home. The CV-22 is an excellent aircraft. And for somebody that's flown their entire career at 120 knots to fly at the same low level altitudes and do it at 240 knots is a kick in the pants. Now, you know, the jet jockeys of the world will laugh at that, of course, but nonetheless, it looks complicated, but it's actually a very maneuverable, very fun and easy aircraft to fly. I had the pleasure of getting checked out in that one as well, but the absolute bulk of my flying experience is in the 53. So unfortunately for your sponsors, I'd have to say that product is still the one that's near and dearest to my heart.
Well, that's not that big of a deal because I think they'll understand that. And although I do think the 53 is also just an extraordinary machine. I mean, the first time, was in close proximity to one that was hovering right over me, it was just like, holy crap, that's a big helicopter. and then you get on it and you're just like, wow, can I actually put a school bus back here? Boy,
that's right. Exactly.
It's pretty impressive. Sir, thanks so much for being so generous with your time. It's always a pleasure connecting. I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to do this in person. And certainly, you know, when we get back to some semblance of normal, would like to visit you guys down there and take a look at all the tremendous work you guys are doing across the piece. Thanks so very much for joining us.
Thanks, Vago. You're welcome anytime. It was a real pleasure.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.